This is content section number 3, lighting, for the PDH online course, Survey of Electrical Engineering for Design of Schools. The lighting section begins with an optional narrative. Lighting is a very flaky field. If you say the lighting level in the classroom is 30 foot candles, which is an obsolete imperial measure, that means that a light meter should report 30 foot candles, right? No, never, or maybe for 1 week in 10 years of the life of the fixture. Light bulbs, fluorescent, incandescent, halogen, metal halide, or high pressure sodium start bright and continue to dim out through their lifetime. If you want 30-foot candles and you do standard calculations for 30-foot candles, you get 40, possibly even 50-foot candles initial, and it depreciates over time to 30-foot candles, then 20-foot candles, then maybe 15-foot candles, and it fails. That is lamp depreciation. Open lamps collect dirt. It blocks the light and reduces effectiveness of the reflectors. Closed fixtures collect dirt on the lens. There's something about static electricity that makes the lens first choice for any dust particle. Lamps have a life, but most keep going long after they are dead. The building where I work has decorative metal halide lamps on the building and high-pressure sodium streetlights 10 feet away. The streetlights throw shadows from the building lights on the side of the building. That is, the light sources act as shadows, make shadows from the real light. They've been up there for 10 years or more, and they just appear to be on is all you can say for them. They do not contribute light. Thank goodness for the street lights. Additionally, the human eye responds to light logarithmically. That is, it takes a 1,000-watt lamp to look twice as bright as a 100-watt lamp. The difference between 150 watts and 175 watts is unperceivable. Now to the core content. Before the additional confusion of mandatory energy conservation, the Lighting Society published minimum light levels and made available a method to predict the levels produced by specific fixtures in a specific room. In the printed version of this course, a list for schools is reproduced. I'll give you portions of it here. For instance, computer labs, 2,000 IES foot candles, that's the old name for the Illuminating Engineering Society, and again in 2000, computer labs was 30 foot candles. The list we're reporting from is 2003. Recommended design foot candles for 2003 is 40-foot candles. And then there's another column here, recommended design foot candles for indirect lighting, which is also 40-foot candles. Now remember, this is a computer lab where the kids are looking at a screen in the front where the teacher's presenting material or looking at their PC screen, and the book says there's supposed to be 40-foot candles around them, probably to avoid walking into the furniture. Let's see if there's something that looks like a very conventional. Here, general classroom, 30-foot candles. That's for 2000 IES. Recommended design foot candles in 2003 is 50-foot candles. Now, from my experience in using a foot meter in a lot of schools, 50-foot candles is good lighting. There's nobody that's going to complain about 50-foot candles unless they're doing something with needle-nose pliers and trying to get a tiny wire into a tiny hole. For any reasonable office task, 50-foot candles is very good lighting. But the newer edition of the IESNA, new name for the Lighting Society, handbook has ranges, and they would say something like 30 to 50 foot candles, which to my mind contributes next to nothing. In the printed text, there's a portion for gymnasiums, laundry rooms, a lot of interesting things that you would run into in the detailed design of a school. But the purpose here is to talk about how to read the table and how to read a light meter and how to choose lighting fixtures that will produce a lighting level. Now, obviously, you call the lighting salesman, you say, I want 40-foot candles of the cheapest fixture you got, and he'll give you a layout and he'll give you a part number for it. If you say, I want something a little on the premium side, I have an energy budget and I still want 50-foot candles, he'll give you a different fixture, possibly even a different layout. Note that the 50-foot candles required in 2003 cannot be met by 99% of the commercial lighting fixtures in the numbers permitted by the Energy Conservation Code. to the best of your teacher's knowledge, the only compliant fixture is the Lithonia RT5, which is a strange fixture. I mean, it's worth looking at, and it's economical. Well, economical in the sense that lighting fixtures are premium devices. This is a premium device. But comparing to other lay-in 2x4 lighting fixtures, this Lithonia RT5 is cost competitive and gives you an awful lot of light in a good distribution for very few watts. Lighting fixtures, luminaires. Lighting fixtures come in incandescent, halogen, compact fluorescent, old fluorescent, new fluorescent, metal halide, high-pressure sodium, and some additional forms just entering the market. I've had an opportunity to attend some lighting shows. There's something called cold cathode. And the interesting thing is there's been something called cold cathode for 60 years. But it was like NE2, you know, a little neon lamp. And if you've seen these hot rods where it glows under the engine well, those are cold cathode fixtures. If you do an internet search, that's what you get for cold cathode. But they're starting to sell them as super efficient night lights. And the way the story was told to me, they have just about dominated the Las Vegas Strip because they last forever and they put out decent light and they're available in different colors. They put them on their marquees. The labor of changing them and the eyesore of not changing them is compelling to buy this cold cathode fixture, which they told me at the show, and this is not current information, and certainly not a selling effort, $7 for like 5-watt fixture, but it's very high efficiency, so 5 watts is light. It's real light, but $7 initial cost lasts forever. Lighting fixtures can be recessed mount, surface mount, pendant mount, track mount, probably some other ways. Schools have used recessed 2x4 new fluorescent, that is T5, recessed downlight cans, and a very few specialized architectural fixtures and some maintenance fixtures. Now let's step back to this old fluorescent, new fluorescent. It used to be an F40CW. You ever remember hearing that? For years and years and years, I remember they were still using incandescent when I was in school in the 50s, and when they retrofitted that building, they put in the F40 cool whites, and they were in use until well past 2000. Some of them were replaced along the way, and occasionally even a baluster fixture was replaced. Those have been outlawed by the federal government. They're just not energy adequate in the look of the government, and actually other people would agree with them pretty easily. The newest, and there's been several iterations, but the newest is the T5, where 5 indicates 5 millimeter in diameter. Now, if you're holding your thumb in front of you, your thumb is a little wider than 5 millimeters. So you've got an idea that these T5 lamps are small. And they have another peculiarity. They're very temperature sensitive. If you have a cold breeze across them, they dim. So don't put them where you got a cold breeze. And again, in a ceiling recessed fixture, there's no reason to think you would have a cold breeze. But be aware of that. They have some special characteristics. Downlight cans are the kind of thing you might have over the fireplace at home. Architects like to put them. They're a nice fixture. And again, with a halogen lamp and a ballast, they put out a lot of light, and you know they do a good job of making it safe to walk down the halls and making it attractive to look at display cases and things like that. Wonderful catalogs, without prices, are available on the internet and in paper from manufacturers such as Lithonia, Holophane, Hubble, and more and more and more and more. Lighting, exterior lighting. Exterior lighting includes wall wash, parking lots, and security. Wall wash is a surface-mounted metal halide or high-pressure sodium that lights the building and the yard or the lot nearby. Something like this is required by the building code at pedestrian entrances and exits. Let's interject a little bit of author's message or optional narrative here. For years, there was this controversy about the color of high-pressure sodium and the color of metal halide, and before that, the color of mercury vapor. And you know what? It's meaningless. It's one of these things where everybody has opinions and they want to state them, but it has no significance in reality. I was telling you about walking into work. I walk into work every morning before the sun comes up. The street lights are high-pressure sodium. The buildings and the signs are metal halide. They look fine together. Where the light spreads over each other, it's not like there are sharp outlines or edges or anything. To me, to me, it's imperceivable. There is a difference, and high-pressure sodium is more efficient. You get more light per dollar invested or per kilowatt of energy purchased. But again, the eye is insensitive to minor changes, so it's within the measurement error of the test. Parking lots are normally lit by small shoebox fixtures on 20-foot poles. The catalogs identify each fixture with a spacing to mounting height ratio. This tells you how many you need for a specific lot after you've chosen a pole height. If the count is too high, use a longer pole, and the count reduces proportionately. Security lighting has three purposes: comfort level, CCTV observation, and police observation. Most people are comfortable walking through a well-lit parking lot. There will be complaints when a lamp burns out. If CCTV observation is in place, it needs light to pick up images, but not as much as you might think. Most places rely on police driving by occasionally to deter vandalism. Some lighting must be present to illuminate perpetrators. Shoeboxes on 20-foot poles work. Properly placed wall washers work. Bollards, 3-foot posts with down lights work also. Lighting power distribution. As discussed previously, the main distribution panel provides a feeder circuit to the local 480-277-volt lighting panel. The lighting panel provides lighting circuits, which travel around an area. Each room has a wall switch, and then the power goes to the fixtures in that room. A single 277-volt circuit provides 16 amps, that's the 80% rule we talked about before, times a 20% standard circuit breaker rating, or 16 amps times 277 volts for 4432 volt amperes. A 2x4 fixture draws somewhat less than 100 volt amperes. Therefore, 44 fixtures can be supplied by a single circuit, or about 4 classrooms. And a sample lighting wiring plan is included in the written version of this. And what the drawing shows is the 2 kindergarten rooms that were used in the previous example, just because it was readily available and kind of interesting in its own right. I thought it was interesting to have a row of computers for kindergartners, but I've had the opportunity of walking through schools and seeing the kindergartners using them, and they're proficient. They're not doing Microsoft Word, but they've got some real attractive games and activities they do on them. Artwork. Anyway, these kindergartens, there's an exit sign shown, an egress light, and a dedicated circuit for this. Again, life safety requires dedicated circuits, cannot be commingled with general wiring. There are external wall washes, so that you can look out the window at night. Again, most schools are multi-use buildings now, and they're anticipating using them at night, and it's kind of fun to look out the window and, you know, see the deer going by or whatever happens in your neighborhood. There is a home run shown from the exterior lighting circuit, and it says LPB2-3 via lighting contactor C4. That says that the lighting panel is called LPB2. It is on circuit 3, but there's either photocell or a building automation switch operating the contactor, turning the power on and off. Then we got 2x4 lay-ins. An occasional night light that is not switched comes from the same circuit as the switched lights, but it is not switched. The emergency lights in this particular example, the emergency lights come from a central generator, and that has to be an independent circuit. On the battery-operated units, they must come from the local power circuit for the local light, so that the emergency light knows when the local light is out. When you've got a central generator, it only knows if the main building service is out. And there's a little bit of a problem there, but nobody's worrying about it, so you and I won't worry about it either. Classroom lights, hall lights, night lights, light switches, or motion detectors. There's a very peculiar symbol on the particular drawing that was used there. It looks like a spades, you know, from a deck of cards. I think it's a motion detector. I did not copy the legend for this. Very important to have a legend so that people reading your drawings know what you're talking about. Lighting control. The purpose of lighting control is user convenience and energy conservation. User convenience means that the teacher can dim the lights when using video projection, but leave enough light for notes and to control the students. Energy conservation means complying with contradictory, arcane, arbitrary bureaucratic regulations. As alluded to in the fixture selection section, the funding agency design guide specifies minimum foot candles and maximum watts per square foot. However, both are measures of lighting level with a given fixture or type of fixture. When a minimum and maximum are specified, only the range in between is available as a solution. Unfortunately, the maximum watts per square foot is below the minimum foot candles, and they want to review the calculations before releasing the money. Other energy conservation requirements from the funding agency design guide include two-level switching, preemptory motion detectors, time clock control, and lighting control from the building automation system. Two-level switching used to mean that the outside tubes in a four-tube 2x4 fluorescent were switched with one circuit and the inner tubes were switched with another circuit. This still works, but the newer electronic ballots permit the same result with high-low levels on only two tubes. And again, this RT5 I was telling you about utilizes or has available the two-level electronic ballot, so you can get high-low out of two tubes. And the demonstration is very impressive. Preemptory motion detectors mean that the wall switches can turn the lights off, but only the motion detectors can turn the lights on. This is how the hardware comes from the factory and how the manufacturer's installation's instructions work. The National Electric Code requires that hardware be installed per the manufacturer's instructions, or the electrical inspector is supposed to red tag the job. An installation detail for a motion detector follows in the written version of the course. This is based on a particular brand that works very well, and obviously the wiring will be slightly different for slightly different types. It shows a home run to the lighting panel with two number 12s and a number 12 ground, the lighting fixture that gets the power, then three number 12s and a number 12 ground going down to something called a PP. And in the legend it says a PP is a power pack / relay. The power pack is hooked up by three number 16s and a number 16 ground to something called a DT. In the legend, a DT is a dual technology motion detector. Then there is a wire coming off of this to the building automation system, three number 16s with a 16 ground, and two number 16s going to a local light switch. So what's going on here? We have a specialized relay low voltage power source that will accept commands from the light switch, accept commands from the dual technology motion sensor, and accept commands from the building automation system. Now, I actually installed these in a elementary school expansion. They work very, very well. I mean, well beyond anyone's expectations. There was a cost premium to get the external control for the building automation system, but we were worried about security in that particular school, and we wanted it was the gym we were most worried about. We wanted the coach to be able to turn on all the lights, even though the school guidelines say it's got to be on the motion detector. We gave the coach an override so he could turn on all the lights if there were a problem, and he wanted to make sure he knew who was doing what. This particular unit comes with a master on and a master off. Master off might be a good idea for energy savings. I have severe reservations on this. I focus much more intensely on security than on energy conservation. And I like turning lights on a lot more than turning lights off. Maybe taking it down to a low level, turning off alternate fixtures, things like that. But I really don't like making it dark when there's a chance somebody's getting hurt out there. And this is a preemptory motion detector. The only way it works is when the dual technology motion sensor says turn on the light. You can switch the switch all day long. If it doesn't pick up motion, it doesn't turn on the light. And again, that's one of the reasons why we put the manual override on this. And again, the manual override is part of the manufacturer's instruction on this particular model. On the low-end model that has only motion detector and switch connection, again, switch the switch all day long, nothing happens. Only the motion detector can turn it on. If anything fails, or if you really want those lights on awful bad, it's tough luck, buddy. Other energy conservation, oh, we did that, didn't we? Two-level switching, inside tubes and outside tubes, or the two-level ballast now. Let's read the description of that illustration I was just talking about. The number 16 conductors are low voltage, do not have to be in conduit, but usually are per project specifications. Dual technology motion detectors use infrared and ultrasonic. The ultrasonic can see behind partitions as in bathroom stalls or a kid. They pick up on different bases, and the dual technology turns off the lights when everyone is working quietly. Wait a minute, that wasn't the way it's supposed to work. How come it does work that way? Not only it works that way in classrooms, it works that way in conference rooms. For 20 years, I've been putting in demonstrations in the conference rooms, places where I work. Every one of them turns off the lights while people are working in there quietly. If there's motion, they detect motion and turn the lights on. If there's no motion, even though there are people there working, they turn the lights off. But the world says we use motion detectors. Maybe we can diddle with the sensitivity on them. The power pact, power switching, low voltage power supply, and logic, accepts external commands, normally from the building automation system, to turn lights on and to turn lights off. This is very valuable for security to turn them on and for energy conservation to turn them off. The control scheme is done on a per room or per space basis. The manufacturer for this particular scheme is Wattstopper, a very reputable and well-known company at www.wattstopper.com. And they publish some excellent application guides. They also have competitors and their alternate technologies available. In the written version, I didn't pursue this, but the big guys like Square D and Cutler Hammer are real big on smart panel boards where there's a computer in the power distribution panel. And I haven't pursued these extensively because, to me, it's an abomination. I mean, I like the idea of a panel board as copper bus bars and replaceable circuit breakers. The idea of having a computer in there just doesn't appeal to my aesthetic. But they have a way of doing it where you would have a motion detector in the classroom go back to the panel board, and that would switch on or off the circuit breaker for that particular classroom. Or, again, you could have building automation turn off everything in the wing. There are other ways of doing it. Lighting contactors are 1880 technology. They originated with Thomas Edison. The time clock operates a coil. The coil pulls in the contacts. The lights come on. Mechanical clocks are understandable. The system is totally reliable, except for requiring a reset after a power interruption. Time clocks are shown on the plan drawings earlier for external lights and hallway lights. Optional narrative. The latest electronic time clocks follow the Microsoft convention of concealed essential commands, unrecoverable errors, and unreadable documentation. So it is perhaps that I've had bad experience with electronic time clocks. But again, you can still buy the mechanical ones, cheaper than the electronic ones, and they work and work and work. The only downside I've ever perceived is that they require a reset after a power interruption. And in the written version of the course, there's a detail for the time clock and power contactor. We've got three phases of 277, 480, that's three hots coming through a circuit breaker, circuits 38, 40, and 42, going through three poles of a lighting contactor. One goes for building lighting. At the time this detail was made, there was a spare and a second spare. Subsequent to my copying it for our course, somebody came by and said, hey, let's put the parking lot lights on that. And it makes very, very good sense, except some people like to leave the building on all night and turn the parking lots off at midnight. But again, this is what they wanted, and they got what they wanted. The control on this has 120 continuous going into the timer, has a three-position selector switch. In the automatic position, the timer turns the lighting contactor on and off. In the off position, nothing turns on the lighting contactor. And in the hand position, they all come on. This is something I learned a long time ago. I always put in on my jobs. And I suspect a lot of electricians and construction managers delete it because they can save a couple hundred dollars. The problem is, how do you identify light bulbs that need replacing during the day? You got to come back at night to find out which bulbs are out. If you've got the handoff auto, you put it in hand, you walk around during the daytime, it's pretty easy to see which ones need replacement, and then you call in the contractor, rent the bucket truck, however you handle this, and go up and replace the lights. Ah, a fourth position is possible on the switch. Remember, we hit hand, off, and auto. The fourth one would be BAS for building automation, if building automation control is to be included. And again, the computer for the school turns it on whenever the computer thinks you should turn it on, turns it off whenever you think the computer thinks you should turn it off. Building automation is the current buzzword for HVAC controls. The HVAC control vendors want to run the fire alarm, building lighting, emergency smoke removal, access control, and intrusion alarms. Unfortunately, they do not understand life safety and the requirements for UL-approved components and certified technicians. They also do not like to include manual overrides. Maintenance contract profits far exceed installation costs. We proceed now to the discussion of telephone and data in the next main section and the next audio section. Please join me.